Gundo here, and I'm very sorry about last week's disappearance. It seems that the producer wanted to take advantage of something I had carefully worded into my contract. Namely, not to talk about that reprehensible decade, the 1970s. Fortunately, this week's guest allows us to shift one decade earlier. Dana Spiada runs a nice restaurant in upstate New York called The Rose and Kettle with her husband. But she's also the author of Eat the Document, a book that our young roving correspondent insists is the cat's pajamas. I wouldn't know. I'm allergic to cats, and I sleep in the nude. Anyway, before we abdicate to our young roving correspondent, I'd like to introduce a new feature.
Free book giveaway.
Yes, it's true. We've apparently become so self-important that this week we're giving away a free copy of Dana Spiada's Eat the Document. So, here's the deal. All you have to do is answer the following philosophical question.
If you were a fish, what type of fish would you be and why?
Email your answer to this question along with your mailing address to one of the people who runs this show. The email address is ed@edrants.com. That's E-D-R-A-N-T-S. The fourth person to send in this email will in fact receive a free copy of the book. But for the other three participants, don't worry. We'll be contemplating your responses on the air in a future show. Again, the address is ed@edrants.com. Anyway, on to the interview.
So, I am here with Dana Spiada, who is the author of Eat the Document and Lightning Field. Dana, how are you doing today?
Good, thanks for having me.
Yes, thanks for, you missed our wind and rain, but you got the sunniness. So, I wanted to first of all talk about the influence of Catherine Ann Power, who I understand that Mary is based off of. How did this origin come to be?
Well, she's not based on Catherine Ann Power. Catherine's Power inspired aspects of the book, but it's definitely not meant to be her. Mm-hmm. Definitely. My imagination that took over at a certain point. What I was interested in is not so much that Catherine Ann Power did something to go underground or that she surrendered, but I was interested in the time in between her long years and the fact that she had a son while she was underground and the conflicts that would bring up, about whether you could turn yourself in or not, and that they start to ask questions at a certain point, children do. And I was also interested in her because she seemed, Catherine Ann Power seemed like someone who was trying to be a good person in good faith, and she did this, or she participated in this terrible thing. She was involved in a bank robbery where someone was killed, and I was interested in that idea, how a good person can end up doing something terrible, and I think there's a specific time that enables a specific social context for Catherine Ann Power, and I was interested in that social context, the early 70s, before the Vietnam War ended, but when it had been dragging on for quite some time.
Now, did you know that Power actually owned and operated restaurants?
Yeah, I did know that.
Yeah,
too.
I was wondering if that was a commonality thing. Well, that kind of.
The restaurants make sense because you can get jobs in restaurants very easily, and it's a very easy place to invent a new identity because they often hire undocumented workers, as you probably know. So.
Okay. Well, the interesting thing about this is that you sort of made a decision to kind of keep the incident or the aftermath of or whatever victims of Mary's crime or terrorist act in this deliberately vague. And I was wondering, we don't actually see in this book any sort of real sort of, with the exception of the characters who center around this incident, we don't see, like, for example, in the case of Power, I noticed that, like, Walter Schroeder's daughter had some very scathing things to say about her,
Certainly.
Even though she was only an accessory. But I'm wondering why you didn't have a character like this in this book, or was this just too much scope for you to take on? Or?
Well, I mean,
there's a lot you take on in this book.
I mean, I think that's been done. You know, the kind of the point of view of the a lot of the books that I've read that had sort of these kind of events in them sort of started with the family of that had been affected and been killed, and I really wanted to do something different. I was really interested in more of the ordinary experience of this underground experience and the social context. And so I steered away from that. And, you know, as you say, you have to pick and choose where you're going to put your focus.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, one also might draw parallels between like the ambiguity of guilt and also the ambiguity of how far do you go to sort of make political act. Was this an intentional sort of parallel you were drawing in this book, or
something that was parallel to what?
The parallel is sort of like, you know, what is the nature of guilt when one actually goes ahead and becomes involved with like sort of a terrorist action,
right,
like for example,
right,
like Catherine Power, right, and like presumably Mary,
right,
in terms of like, well, did she or did she not pull the trigger? That's
right,
that's the question. There's a
right,
sort of like an ambiguity there.
Right.
Likewise, there's also an ambiguity of like how far you were supposed to go with an
right,
accepted sort of nonviolent political protest
right,
versus
right,
like a,
well,
by any means necessary.
Yeah, and it was I think that by 1972, a lot of people were frustrated, people who had been peaceful political protesters, and were going to attracted to more extreme means. And the characters in my book don't intend to kill anyone. They intend only property destruction. But of course, they do end up injuring someone. I don't think we're giving a lot away by saying that.
No.
And they have to deal with the consequences of that. And it's very naive to think that they wouldn't kill somebody. And but I also think that acting in the world is fraught with a lot of, tactics have to be thought through, and there are consequences. Just as there are also consequences to not doing anything mm-hmm, when you see something wrong. And I try to deal with that in my book, too. It's I'm interested in all the complicatedness of it.
Yeah. There was actually a review here in the Chronicle, actually, the San Francisco Chronicle, by Amy Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And she, you know, this kind of goes into Eat the Document, but comparing it against Lightning Field,
mm-hmm,
she said that Lightning Field was sort of to entertain the muse, and the latter book is more sort of serious, meant to challenge,
right,
disturb, and educate. I mean, do you find this dichotomy valid? Do you see a distinct separation in terms of tone between the two books?
No. I mean, Lightning Field was a pretty serious book, too.
Yeah.
It had humor in it, and Eat the Document has humor in it, too.
Yeah.
So I didn't see the distinction that she saw, not really. I think they have different, they're interested in a different culture. One's one culture is a politically astute culture, and the other one is not, so that maybe is what she's talking about.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, that's true. Maybe politics is a serious business.
Well,
I think politics can be funny, too. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I mean, if you think about the anti-corporate stuff that is in the contemporary part of the book, a lot of that has a lot of humor and irony in it, and certainly I think there are things in the book that in Jason's sequences that are meant to be funny.
Well, it reminded me very much, we have here in the San Francisco Bay Area the Billboard Liberation Front.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
They inspired there are several groups that are like that.
Yeah.
And I think all that anti-corporate and anti-ad stuff does have a lot of humor and wit, and that's part of their power.
Mm-hmm.
And there were activists in the late 60s and early 70s that also had wit and irony, like Abby Hoffman and the Yippies.
Levitation,
exactly. I see a direct line.
Well, there's actually a lot of interesting sort of similarities I noticed between the two books, and I enjoyed them both.
Oh, good. I'm glad. You know, that's very smart, because a lot of people can't pick up on that there are similarities.
Well, like, for example, like, you know, both books feature a woman picking up a man in the bar. Now, they have totally different consequences in both Lightning Field and Eat the Document, but I noticed that was a similarity. Barbie doll seems to fascinate you. We have the Super 8 film in Eat the Document,
and we
have the incineration of Barbie dolls in Lightning Field.
Okay.
What else do I have here? Oh, yeah, both have, you know, men staring intently at computers.
That's true.
I was looking, going like, Jesus, I mean, you know.
That's true. It's interesting. It's kind of... also, they both have... women with secret lives as
That's very true. That's very true. But I mean, since there's so many sort of very specific similarities, I was wondering if you could comment upon this. Are you sort of...
It's not deliberate.
It's not deliberate? Yeah.
No.
How deliberate and how subconscious?
I think your brain is attracted to certain images, themes, and it kind of comes back in a different way, and I think that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you do want people to think... And also, I mean, I deal with language in a very similar way. The actual sentence structures are similar, the way that I like to do paragraphs and the way I like to list things. And, I mean, I think it's me,
mm-hmm,
and it's going to be a version of me, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, not that I'm those characters, but I'm the author, so there's going to always be these kind of weird... subconscious things that come out.
Well, I guess the other thing also was the overt style, mm-hmm, in both books. In Lightning Field, you have like the sort of scripted kind of camera things, which were very funny.
Right.
And then in this, you have more, it's sort of diluted down to sort of Jason's journal.
Well, there's also the movies too.
That's true. Film one, film two. Yeah.
Two films in both movies.
Well, I guess in terms of sort of tracking, maybe you can comment upon your development as a writer as to sort of what you've done between the two books to kind of get the style a little bit more honed like that and a little bit more restrained.
As you go along, I think you get better at it, I hope, and also that there's a whole bunch of. This was a more ambitious book, that and more out of my experience, and took a lot more research. Although Lightning Field had research too, but this took more.
Well, you also researched like ICQ and Skype, which I'm wondering, these are very, very specific things, and they're only in vague moments of this book.
Yeah, well, see.
I was wondering if you
a
could
a lot of it doesn't even end up
this.
In the book, you know?
Ah.
I mean, I did so many years. I love to do research. Yeah. I love to sort of immerse myself in something that I'm writing about, almost like an actor does that when they do a part. It's part of the joy of writing for me. But a lot of it isn't necessary, and even if it's really good and if it's not, doesn't need to be there, it has to go. And this book was much longer and ended up cut down. I cut it down to make it better.
You worked on this for 6 years then?
5 years.
5 years, 5 years. So what was the original draft of this like?
It wasn't so different from what it is now. It just had more of things, and I realized I didn't need quite so much to get the same point across, and I would like to get across the least amount of words possible.
Gotcha. It's interesting. How do you go about plotting your books, exactly? I mean, they're very, very unusual structures in both books, but in particular this one, it's even more like the reader is kind of trying to figure out how things work together.
Yeah, it took a lot of effort to what I wanted to. I knew that the book would start with her after the event, and I knew that you wouldn't find out what her action was till the end. I knew those two things. And I knew that she would be, and I wasn't even sure you were going to find out at first what the action was, but I knew I wasn't going to tell you at the beginning. And I knew that it would start out with her going underground. And then while it continued in the 70s, it would also, there would be a contemporary part, and they would eventually meet.
Yeah.
I knew that would happen. I guess structurally that seems to be, had suspense in it and keep you going. It helped the pace of the book. And I think I have movies are a big influence on me, so I think that some of my narrative style comes from that, montaging and sort of editing, you know, putting juxtaposing different things for effect. But a lot of novelists do this too, but I think that's probably where I get it from.
Yeah. I was wondering, now, I know Don DeLillo has championed you, but I also see a definite kind of influence, particularly with like his Libra and Mao too in your books. I was wondering if you could talk about DeLillo's influence upon you as a writer, and also what are some of your other literary influences?
Sure. I think DeLillo is a great writer, and I have read all his books. So I think that I learned a lot about dialogue from reading him. I like the way he does dialogue. I like his sentences always. I don't really think that I write like him. I wish that I mean, I don't think I write like him. I write like myself, but yeah. I think that his the way he uses paragraphs and this kind of he has very poetic language, but it's also has an austerity to it as well, and a clean quality. So he doesn't. It's there's not a sloppy bad sentence in any of his books. So I aspire to that certainly.
But I don't know to sort of. If there's a weakness to DeLillo, sometimes you can come across as cold and clinical at times. And with your work, I find it to sort of have this kind of West Coast sense of feeling, actually. And actually, it's interesting that you've taken large portions of both novels and set them on the West Coast.
Right. Well, I lived here a lot, so even in Northern California, briefly, when I was in junior high school, I lived in the suburbs here. So, and I lived in Seattle for 5 years. I don't know. The West Coast is the place of new beginnings.
Yeah.
And also radical politics and youth culture and alternative culture. Not that those things aren't in the East Coast, but it just seems it's more so here.
I guess to sort of be a little direct, it's sort of like I get this kind of goofball quality to a lot of like some of your sequences. Like for example, all the groups in the bookstore, who have the acronyms.
Right.
So do you find yourself kind of constantly at battle with this goofball impulse? Or do you find yourself sort of at battle with this kind of goofball impulse?
No, I don't think of it as goofball. I think it's smart.
No. Okay, quirky. No, I mean, I like it. Don't get me wrong. I'm just trying to sort of get a sense of like how you balance this very sort of
I see what you're saying.
Deep,
okay.
Really intense perception with this kind of this quirky
Oh, the more playful
element.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, you know, it's fun to do both, and you do have to balance it. I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I think that that's, I mean, it's
but, and tightly plotted, too.
Right.
I'm just wondering what sort of, maybe you could sort of offer some idea about what steps you take as a writer to kind of get that sort of holy trinity kind of in your book.
You know, just a lot of revision and really thinking about it as whether all these elements are coming together in the way that you want and you're not overdoing something. And sometimes that takes a lot of time because when you've been working on something a long time, you have this kind of this kind of scaffolding that exists to get you from one place to another in the writing, and you don't realize that you don't need it anymore. You're afraid the thing will fall down, but you don't need it, and you can get rid of it. And sometimes it takes a little while to realize it because you're so used to seeing those passages in the manuscript because you've had them there.
Yeah.
And you realize, oh, you know what? Let's just cut this part out, go from here to here. It works better.
Sure.
And you have to take a break maybe for a month and then come back to it and see that. So that's why I work slowly, partially because it takes me a long time. I'm not this, you know, it takes me a long time to figure these things out. I'm not not that quick.
But going back to this issue of plotting, I mean, what level of plotting do you do? Do you outline? Do you
write a continuous draft? Oh, sorry, I didn't really answer that.
Yeah, batting a lot of questions at you. So.
I do map it out, and I do diagrams, and I do timelines. That's the real challenge is when you're working with different time periods is getting all the timelines right for me. And the novel has a specific relationship to time that's very interesting to me. I like how things unfold over time in a novel and that you can have themes come back, time and time again in different versions. And the more you work on it, the more you can connect all these elements up. What's very pleasing to me is connecting everything up. So after you're kind of in revision, you're making diagrams and you're making note of which words you're using and which what are the things that are already there that are coming up, and what do they mean? And it's almost like your subconscious is this better writer than you are. And if you just let some of that stuff come out, you can kind of hone it and make it work even better. So it's a kind of going with intuition and then going with a very deliberate revision and kind of going back and forth and letting both of those things come into play that makes it when it's good, you know. And it's hard to do sometimes. Sometimes it feels like you don't want things to get too self-conscious. You don't want it to be overly wrought.
Yeah. Well, the other thing too about your structure is that it also requires a lot of faith from the reader to carry on continuing.
Yes.
It's like there better be a payoff here,
because
that's one thing I was reading this going, I know it's going somewhere, but it better not fizzle out.
Well, I just really feel like the end of the book is really important, and it's really important for everything to have that payoff in the end. And I also think that you have to give readers a lot of credit that you can make leaps.
Sure.
And they're happier when they make leaps because it's less boring to read than something that kind of has tons of exposition and points you down this very predictable road. Let's just leave a little mystery and leave you hanging, and I like to doing it that way. But I bet you're right. I bet some people lose patience with it and throw it across the room.
Well, the other thing that was interesting about this book is that you stopped just short of September 11th.
Yes.
And I don't know, in terms of thinking about a lot of these angles in terms of like, well, what is an action of change? This seems to me a very interesting sort of decision for you.
Mm-hmm.
So is this book intended as kind of a sort of chronicle of the last 40 years up before September 11th, or does it encounter, I mean, you know, this is a very important issue, I think, for...
Sure, certainly. I mean, I started writing the book before September 11th, obviously, and then September 11th happened, and I wanted it to take place in 1999 because of the Battle of Seattle and all the anti-corporate stuff that was going on, and anti-globalization stuff that was going on in Seattle. So that was and that was the recent past when I started it.
Yeah.
And September 11th did change a lot of the dynamics of dissent and protest and tactics. But that's not what this book is about. It's not a September 11th novel. So I purposely didn't go beyond a certain point because I didn't want to change the novel to being a September 11th novel. I wanted it to be what it was, which was an examination of these two time periods, an examination of especially the social context of the early 70s.
Well, I guess, though, I mean, I'm not suggesting that it's intended as a September 11th novel. But
I'm just saying that's why I didn't go beyond a certain
point. Okay, but I mean, certainly, though, September 11th would be a factor in sort of contemplating an issue. Was this too much to handle, or was this just this kind
of complicated? No, it's just a different book. It would be a different book. It would be a book that would have to be about September 11th, and I didn't want it to be a book about September 11th.
Now, cultural reference also plays a pivotal
role
in this, in your work. But I don't really get the sense that you're sort of like name dropping a lot of these references. It's sort of like, you know, I'm actually getting an informed reference that with like sort of background, like you mentioned Brian Wilson's long delayed smile with the Beach Boys, as opposed to just like you read another novel, like, you know, say, Bret Easton Ellis or Stephen King, and it's like the reference is there and there's no sort of context for it. I was wondering if you could elaborate on exactly how you use cultural references, or you justify them?
That's a good question, I think. I think that because I am interested in social context and cultural context, I think it would be silly not to have some of these names in there, because that's the way real people talk in the real world. They do make reference to other things. But there has to be an organic reason for it in the novel. And mostly the things that I refer to are things that I have found are necessary, I think. Or they just have some beauty to them that I can't resist. Either the language, the actual name is beautiful, or it is something about it is compelling to me, but most of the time it's because it's something I've come across that seems an authentic part, just like you described the color of your shirt or the weather. You're also describing something, she went to go see, you know, she saw this movie and she got her hair cut like Jane Fonda in Clute or something like that. Or you're going to be listening to a record, why not be specific? And I don't think you have to get all the references to understand the book. Some of them are very obscure. Just like in Lightning Field, there were a lot of obscure movie references in that book. It's not important. Most people are not going to get those references, but I still think you can get the idea that it's an insider world, and these are the actual things that people in that context would say to each other. And the authenticity, I think, is there.
But I guess what I was sort of suggesting is that Jason talks about the Beach Boys at length. Now, let's say like sort of some sort of, you know, literary scholar 60, 70 years from now, let's say the Beach Boys somehow wane in popularity. Now, all of a sudden, there's an explanation for them. And this is sort of like a valuable sort of historical service, because not a lot of writers do this.
That's a good idea.
This is kind of what I was trying to get into. You do this more than most novelists, I think. And I was doing this. I wanted to kind of get a sense of how these sort of...
So I'm an archive...
How these folders unfold.
An archivist of popular culture.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. How do you determine which reference is the one that you should sort of explain for a pitch?
Because it's something that I think is, like I said, has some interest and beauty to it. Mm-hmm. And it's also authentic to the character and the situation. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I know myself and am interested in myself. If it's not interesting to me, I'm not going to write about it. So, for example, the Beach Boys, I love the Beach Boys, and that's from my own experience, basically. Sure. And all music that I write about in the book is music that I love. So that's partially why. Just like all the movies in Lightning Field were all movies that I saw and loved.
Okay. Well, going to another sort of thing that you do that not a lot of novelists do, and that is... motorcycle helmet dropping. Food. And this obviously comes from sort of your experiences and your life experience.
Right.
But simultaneously, I think what people have to eat and how they eat it is something that really is very Balzacian. And yet, we don't really see this in contemporary literature. And yet, you are very specific about what people eat, like the white wine spritzers, too. You know?
Right.
I was wondering, if you could sort of talk about the role of food that kind of...
I never thought of that. Is there a lot of food in my books?
Yeah, I think
okay.
so. Okay.
Well, certainly
I like
in Lightning it. Field, yeah. too. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
It's,
I mean, I guess... any... I really am important... I really think it's important to get small details accurate.
Yeah.
So, for example, in some of the early 70s stuff, there's a lot of things about the colors of the room, the kind of mustard yellows and the greens. And I just think it's those tiny details... lend a lot of authenticity, more than saying, and then it was, you know, on the news was such and such, and that's how come we know it's 1972. No, let's give the subtler background. What were people eating? What were they wearing? What were they thinking about? What was the last record that they bought?
Yeah.
You know, what was on 60 Minutes that week? What were the ads that they saw?
Yeah, lots of product placement. Yeah. But food specifically we're talking about here, and, mm-hmm. and why? How much do you sort of dwell upon food when you're sort of dealing with a moment to chronicle?
I don't think about it. I don't. It just comes up. I guess.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I guess food's important to me. I love food, so
yeah, well.
There it is. I thought everyone cared about food.
Well, I think most people do, but there are varying levels of care.
Right. Yeah, I guess for me that's a big part of the details, yeah.
Oh, I want to go back to you.
Okay.
We didn't actually get, we're jumping up or we're bouncing around
okay,
here. But
okay.
Literary influences. We mentioned
okay.
Don DeLillo,
yeah.
but we didn't get into any
yeah,
sort of
Yeah, I think
deeper
DeLillo
one.
Is a genius, and all time or just living people?
Yeah, just who influences you as a writer? Where did you get these sort of, did you pick up any tips in structuring?
Yeah, I thought a lot about, William Faulkner, mm-hmm. As I Lay Dying, actually was a really important book to me in terms of how you use chapters and how you use language. James Joyce, mm-hmm. how you use, James Joyce uses popular culture a lot in Ulysses.
Yes,
and I like David Foster Wallace as a contemporary writer. I like Virginia Woolf. Mm-hmm. I like very much A.M. Holmes and Laurie Moore. Laurie Moore's very funny. She's very witty. I like Rick Moody because he's got that emotional connection as well as this very smart kind of cultural analysis too. Mm-hmm. He's got it, you know. So there's a lot. I guess that's off the top of my head. That's the best I can do. Is that enough? Oh,
no.
Joy Williams. I love Joy Williams, too. She writes. She has a kind of a political edge to her writing, and she's funny, and she writes about young people in an interesting way. I think she's great.
Now, satire crops up in both to varying degrees, and yet it's also kind of a muted satire. And I was wondering
right.
if you can kind of, do you sort of, can you write a novel without any satire, or if you could sort of describe this kind of...
I think that you're right. I think the satire is muted, because I do take the situations very seriously. I do like to sometimes point up the ironies or exaggerate things slightly for effect. I don't know if I really I don't know about how I don't know because how I would if I would change that or not. It may come up or not. It's not something I deliberately plan to do.
Yeah.
It just ends up being how I'm. My point of view then, and how I'm interested in the subject.
So it's largely perspective, I guess, and life
yeah.
experience. I mean, you have a very good angle about, you have all sorts of conversations you're probably overhearing at the restaurant.
That's true. I have a restaurant, and I do observe people
yeah.
as they eat,
therefore,
and as they drink.
Honing being an absolute expert in the way food-related human behavior.
Exactly. That's probably where I get it from. Yeah, very much so. And I've worked in restaurants my whole life, so I do have a lot of... superficial social interactions with people, for better or for worse.
But people reveal a lot in restaurants.
They do.
And I was wondering if, and often find the server invisible. It's really
yes,
disgusting.
Yes.
I hate
yes,
it. But,
yes.
But I mean, I guess, you know, in terms of dialogue, do you find this influence on your fiction?
I do listen to people talk, and I am interested in how people, I'm interested in how people don't really listen to each other. They
yeah.
talk over each other, or they answer the question that was asked a few minutes ago, and I'm interested in how you can make dialogue on the page seem like dialogue in real, you know, seem as though it were dialogue in real life, and it's challenging because you have to just do some stylization to get a kind of unstylized feel,
yeah.
if that makes any sense.
No, it does, definitely. The interesting thing that we've been seeing in the last couple of years in fiction, and we're going back to Eat the Document, is that there have been a lot of, like, you know, books dealing with, like, you know, T.C. Boyle's Drop City.
Right.
Christopher Sorrentino's Trance.
Right.
And these are all books that deal
with... The Darling and American Woman and yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I was wondering if you could offer an explanation for why we're seeing this sudden resurgence of 1960s, 1970s kind of people on the run. And
I think it's very interesting to a novelist, the idea of an underground life is appealing to a novelist, because I think all writers have a sort of secret life as writers. And I think that we live in a time now with the current administration
yeah.
where there's a certain amount of frustration, and it reminds a lot of people of, you know, when Richard Nixon was elected in 72, it's sort of like George Bush, people are against this war, and, you know, they're sort of wondering what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And so I think there's some similarities, and I also think that there's that time period is just a very powerful, I think we see now, as this current administration is trying to sort of dismantle a lot of things that were won in the women's movement, the gay rights movement, the civil rights movement, environmental movement, that all started in that 10-year period from 1965 to 1975, that era. As we see these things, they're trying to set them back. I think we appreciate how important those things are and how hard won they were by this time period. And so I think it's hard not to be intrigued by the people that were part of that and contemplate it. I think, so that would be my guess. And I think that also there's, maybe there's some coincidence as well.
But it seems that all these novels have cropped up, like, interestingly enough, and I hate to constantly refer to September 11th, but you know, since that's, you know, unfortunately the reference point, but all of these came after September 11th.
So right.
Like a couple of years after, literally, like 2003 to onward.
Right, right. You
know, so that's kind of a very interesting sort of delayed reaction. Now we're, as you say, sort of reassessing ourselves to fiction. I'd be, you know, then again, all these novels that we've just mentioned here, then none of them are particularly didactic. They merely sort of chronicle.
Exactly. Or I think they're interested in the question, the questions, rather than coming up to conclusions about judging the characters or judging the actions. And yeah, I think that's a good novel shouldn't be didactic.
Yeah. So would you say that you're more of would you say that you're more with Eat the Document, more of an observer, or more of a chronicler, or are you more of a sort of trying to kind of expose systems? Because there seems to be a little bit of both in this book. You know, there seems to be a lot of you know, like for example, the planned commune, and the whole corporate sort of, you know, takeover and things like that. But also, there's also a lot of, you know, very humanly observed moments. And I was wondering if, you know, if you could sort of respond.
I was going for all of it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Going for all, okay.
Why not go for all of it,
sure,
right?
Sure,
if you
why
could
not?
Put it all in there. Yeah, definitely. Definitely, I wanted to have a strong emotional component to the book, passion and human feeling and the human heart. But I also feel that there's a very specific social context and cultural context to human behavior. And so it's impossible to write about people outside of the context of the time that they're living in. And that is definitely sort of a political position, you know, I would say.
Yeah.
If you think, some people think things happen in isolation, I don't think that they do. So I think it's important for us to understand the social and cultural forces. And partially that means going into the past, and partially it means looking differently at the present.
Sure. Okay. Oh yeah, the other comparison I missed out when we were talking about Lightning Field and Eat the Document was that you have Lisa and Miranda, who seem very similar, sort of like, you know, younger woman sort of characters who were kind of somewhat innocent or virtuous or corruptible, and find themselves kind of corrupted throughout the course of each respective book. And I was wondering if you, why this kind of archetype sort of exists in both.
Huh, I didn't see the connection. I could see what you're drawing at. Well, I mean, definitely, Lisa's much more of a victim than Miranda.
Yeah.
Miranda's a woman who's pretty, I think she's pretty astute, she's just young.
Yeah. But both of them are sort of relatively, I mean, the comparison, I think,
they're,
is
you
is
mean
sort of
innocent.
Innocence, and then they come to sort
of
learn.
Yeah, I think that there's some naivete. I mean, definitely, Lisa's a sadder figure, definitely, though, in my view, because she was sort of overwhelmed by the world. And I don't think Miranda's overwhelmed. I think she's going to, you know, be just fine. Mm-hmm. Miranda. I'd rather be Miranda than Lisa.
Well, wouldn't you? If I was... Where did this whole corporate... I mean, did the corporate community, the Algicom sort of thing, did that come... Was that in an earlier draft, and was that kind of whittled down? Because it seemed like almost kind of come near the end of the book, at least in its current form. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
I mean, it's kind of a Josh's, you know, the final nail in Josh's coffin, as he's the character that sort of sells out.
Yeah.
And although, I mean, I think he's not an evil guy or anything, but he definitely sells out and does this thing. And I did see a connection between the commune and the corporation in a funny kind of way, especially if you're someone who's trying to rationalize something.
Yeah.
And I did want to have some of that, an example of the kind of rebel corporate speak, you know, that Nike does or that all these companies do, where they kind of co-opt sort of a rebellion. And it's a big part of the end of the book, is that there's the whole stuff in the mall. And Josh's character is a big part of that. And it's definitely something I wanted to comment on that was going on, that came up, and I just went in that direction.
Well, there's also the kind of the notion in this book that is that how much of these sort of revolutionary impulses or behavior, at least the question that's kind of on the surface, how much of these are actually manufactured? How much of these are sort of like, you know, produced by the shock waves of history or what right. businesses or individuals do? You know, we're getting into clear ambiguities. I mean, I guess to sort of kind of close this, you come away from the book, and there are a lot of questions that are answered, and there are a lot of questions that aren't.
I'm
wondering what you did to sort of how much was ambiguity sort of hanging throughout the course of writing this book? I mean, you know, did you sort of realize as you were making the various associations, like you were mentioning Lacan and the corporation, that there were no all-inclusive answers and that the ambiguities?
Absolutely. I mean, the reason why I write about something is because I don't have the answers, and it's really an inquiry of the mind and the soul for me to write if I'm going to write about something. And more often than not, when you think deeply about something, you run up against, at least in my experience, you run up against paradox and irony and ambiguity. Very few things are absolutely a good thing or absolutely a bad thing, or you know. And I think the novel's one of the few places left in the culture where that is a good thing, and you're allowed to explore that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. So for you, it's more about like trying to at least either expose these ambiguities or kind of take away these associations that you sort of walk away from and kind of dismantle them? Or
exactly. I think that dismantling the given associations is a good job description for a novelist.
Okay. Well, with that in mind, thank you, Dana, very much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much. I had a good time. It's behind them.
Rock, rock, roll, Plymouth, rock, roll.